Okay, is everybody back?
Yes.
Yep, very good. All right, good. So to start with, are there any announcements? Well, I have one. The NOAA's climate.gov site has finally made its soft launch, which means that if you go to climate.gov, you will see the new site now with the clean resources there. And what they're asking is that this small group, like those of us who are on the phone, can go and test it out and sort of let Frank Niepold know if anything is wrong so that they can fix it before they have any big announcements of the site being live. But it is nice to see that the collection is live there. It was really kind of interesting. He had told me that he thought it was going to go, last week he told me it was going to go live on Monday, and Monday, yesterday, I tried it early in like late morning, and it was still the old site. And then about 15 minutes later, Frank sent an email that it was live, and it was like that was when they flipped the switch.
Excellent, excellent.
Good. It actually really looks good.
Yeah.
Very pleased. Nice to have it integrated.
So, and let's see, the other good news is, and I think I might have said this last week, but we're sort of just getting some more clarity on this. You know, everybody knows, I think, that we submitted 9 session proposals to the American Geophysical Union meeting on climate literacy, and one of those 9 we submitted as a union session, which was accepted as a union session. So it's very a unique opportunity. I've been told that it's the first time in this current format of union sessions that there's ever been an education-focused union session. And for those that you don't know, the American Geophysical Union, it's made up of a lot of topical sections such as atmospheric science, oceanography, hydrology, volcanism, plate tectonics, space physics, space electricity, and all kinds of topic areas like that. And a union session is intended to be one that is of interest cross-cutting all of those various domains. So it is a really unique opportunity. And the focus of the session is the role of AGU's scientific community in engaging in climate communication and issues in climate engagement. So we're real excited about that. Are there any other announcements? Okay, well, if not, then we'll move on to our presentation today. As you all know, we have this sequence of 3 sessions during our telecons focused on using social media. A couple of weeks ago, we had Emily Kelleher talk about individual use of social media, and we're moving this week to talking about organizational use of social media and to address climate literacy and climate change issues, and high-profile individuals using social media. And so today we have leading this discussion Ellen Klicka and Maureen Moses from the American Meteorological Society. Ellen is in the AMS policy program and is involved with their communication strategy, media relations, marketing, and social media. And Maureen has a background in geology and is now in the education program at the American Meteorological Society. And so I'm assuming everybody has the slides now, so I will turn it over to Ellen and Maureen to start the conversation.
Awesome. Thank you very much for those introductions. I'm Maureen Moses, and I represent the AMS Education Program.
And I'm Ellen Klicka. I'm with the AMS Policy Program. We hope you had a chance to do some of the homework items that Emily presented on May 7th. If not, go back to the clean teleconference schedule, and you can find her presentation with some items to try at the end of her presentation. What we're going to do today will be less of a tutorial or how-to type of format. We're aiming to go over some examples of how organizations and high-profile individuals have leveraged social networks as a strategic tool to accomplish their communications goals. We'll also present concepts and ideas that will hopefully help you get more out of your experiences consuming social media content and maybe inspire you to apply some concepts in your organization. But for how-to questions, please feel free to follow up with either of us offline after this call.
All right, next slide, so slide two. For those of you who aren't familiar with the American Meteorological Society, it's a member society that represents over 14,000 scientists in the weather, ocean, climate, and hydrologic sciences. It was founded in 1919 and publishes 10 major peer-reviewed journals. Our main office is in Boston, but we have a satellite office in Washington, D.C., which houses the Education and Policy Department, and that's where we're calling you from today. Next slide.
Talking about organizations and your social media goals, when our group, the Policy Program, started to create our social media strategy, we first thought about what our goals were. We ended up creating a list and starting with one goal. What we wanted to do was make sure that these were aligned not only with our overall communications goals, but really the mission of our program. And then over time, when we felt we had good momentum working towards one goal, we slowly moved down this list. Your organization's goals might be slightly different, and you may choose to tackle them in a different order. The main thing is that you carefully consider what you're trying to accomplish before you start. That's a good practice for making efficient use of the time and effort that you spend on the day-to-day activities. Number one, connecting with others in your field. You can connect with people that you know offline, and this can be a way to help keep in touch. I did that when I first started doing press releases on behalf of the AMS Policy Program. I found out who the communications contacts were at AGU, the World Resources Institute, NOAA, some other organizations that we work with, and got to know them, and we decided that it would be beneficial for each of us to follow each other using the organization's accounts on social media, particularly Facebook and Twitter. And following the right organizations and people is kind of an art. You want to have a mix of people who are providing up-to-the-minute news in areas you care about and that share interesting things that you may want to share with your followers. The part about sharing your views can be tricky when it comes to climate change. For instance, you don't want to be dismissed for only making company with a small portion of the community. Number two, a steady stream of ideas. This can help keep your content feed alive during some dead spots. And it's generally a good practice to mix original and shared content because your audience will like the variety. And sharing the content of others shows that you value their ideas and that you're the type of organization that likes to give credit to others where it's due. Number three, you can instantly find out what others are saying about your organization, and this can be helpful if you run into a negative situation where some damage control is needed. Time can be of the essence. Number four, I use the term partner here in a very broad sense. Any person or organization that touches yours or has a stake in your success or vice versa, and this can help protect them, protect their brands, which can in turn protect yours. Number five, extending the reach of your thought leadership. For example, if your organization has a blog, then you can use social media as a way to promote that blog. And number six, the phrasing of this is framed more for commercial organizations, but the concept of promoting your products and services applies to universities and nonprofits and other organizations. And this goal is last for a reason. You don't want to go shouting how great your organization is until you have a network of connections who believe in your brand. So I'll stop here and ask if there are any questions or comments. Okay, now I'll turn it over to Maureen, who will talk about the AMS education program.
All right, and we're on slide four. Based on the idea of having goals for your social media programs, I identify for the AMS education program what our target audience is going to be. And while we do a lot of outreach directly to K-12 educators and college and university faculty, we were missing our connection to scientists in the field as well as students and other members of the society. So I wanted to create a hub where we could show what the AMS education program does by having our audience include not just educators, but also scientists and the students who are very energized to be members of the AMS. On our site, I refer to Facebook, it's an F and T is for Twitter. I try to post things about research news. Especially, one of our main goals is to help educators use real-world activity as like a current event topic or something to engage their students with. Especially, you know,
Maureen, this is Summer. Can I just ask a question? So, if you're trying to broaden your audience, how do you reach those particular people to get them to actually start following you? I mean, it sounds like what you're saying will help keep them engaged, but how do you actually get them to begin with?
Well, I will actually go over that in the next couple of slides.
Okay.
So just an overview.
Sorry.
Don't worry about it. So what I've been doing is on the site, I mainly post our research news, in the field. So the one advantage to using Facebook over Twitter is I can provide a longer prompt for people that may help explain the science in a way that is still maintains the integrity of the research, but also is more directed towards a non-expert audience, which may be like an undergraduate major or a teacher who may have never taken a course in earth science before. We have a lot of opportunities come through our inbox for educators and students, so I'm able to post about deadlines for our, you know, partner organizations and funding agencies to help promote their events as well. And then I also am able to share news about our organization, if different books have been published that might be of interest, post photos of exciting things that are happening around the office, and ask questions just to gauge where people are within our community. So, part of the continued work of this sort of general activity is going to be transitioning it to our interns, because it's a more appropriate intern activity in terms of the amount of time it uses, and creating guidelines so an intern can help keep this going even while I'm focusing on the other aspects of my job. So on to the next slide, which is slide number 5. One of the ways we try to generate new traffic is by using events as a way to build followers as well as, you know, create momentum for our social media. So right now we are hosting our AMS Climate Studies Diversity Program, which is an NSF-funded program where we're bringing faculty from minority-serving institutions to the D.C. area to learn about climate science. So we've been live tweeting from the event. Yesterday, I gave all the participants the relevant information, including a custom hashtag for using on Twitter, where we can automatically keep track of all of the quotes or all the tweets related to the diversity program. It also provides us an opportunity to add tweets or, you know, basically directly communicate with our funders and partner organizations. I at-tweeted NSF during the opening dinner just to remind them that they helped fund this project, as well as today, since they're at NASA Goddard, we've been at-tweeting NASA Goddard, and, you know, those organizations may share that these events are happening, which would expose what we're doing to a larger audience and, in turn, give us more following. And that indeed has happened. Our numbers have been going up this week for our Facebook and Twitter accounts. It also is a great way to demonstrate to the membership of AMS what their membership fees are contributing to. And so it demonstrates how we're increasing diversity in the earth sciences and through our programs, and by their membership, their programs as well, because they're helping fund them and support them. And so we're just gratuitously using hashtags. You know, I've been putting a hashtag or a pound sign in front of climate, as well as diversity and higher ed, because this is a program geared at college and universities. So on to the next slide, which is slide number 6.
Can I just ask, this is Tamara again,
yeah.
Can I just ask a question? When you say gratuitous use of hashtags, so this is when somebody's following you on Twitter, they're using that hashtag, correct? So
yes,
if they happen to follow you with
are.
So that you can put multiple hashtags, and then so multiple groups might be watching that?
Exactly. So if you think about this, like, so let's say three different people are looking at streams based on a hashtag. So someone has looking at a stream that says hashtag climate, very popular. Another person is looking at a stream that is specific to higher education, so they'll be looking at hashtag higher ed. And then another person is looking at something specific to diversity, and so they'll be looking at hashtag diversity. And because I included that hashtag in one tweet, all three people can see that particular announcement because of the use of those hashtags. So when you're using three different hashtags, well, it may look a little ridiculous written out with, you know, pound signs all over the place. What we're doing is we're reaching out to different groups of people. And, you know, because of it, we're getting exposure to higher education audiences, people concerned with diversity, as well as the climate science community, which is always fun to interface with. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thanks.
No problem. All right. So, on, again, we're on slide six. So our first case study that we're going to present about how we used social media as an organization was from our annual meeting, which happened in January of this year in Austin, Texas. Again, this is using an event as a way to generate momentum as well as new followers. Around October of 2012, so a few months before the actual event itself, a group of eager members from the membership committee approached people at the AMS office, and they were very interested in integrating social media into the annual meeting. And Ellen and I had been having conversations internally, and so we found out that there were these groups of people who wanted to use social media at this event. So as a group, we created unique identifiers, and we all essentially promised to not change them around. So we used the hashtag AMS2013, and so if we were talking about the meeting at the event, we would add that hashtag to our tweets. And the way we distributed information about this is we had information posted on the web, but we also created a business card, and this was a relatively inexpensive tool to create. I think it cost us around $100. And what it was a business card size document that had how to contact official AMS sources at the meeting. On one side, we talked about Facebook, which is the picture on the upper left. And on the other side of the business card, we had our official Twitter account information. So if people were at a session hosted by the policy program, they could let policy know that they were interested in what policy was talking about, or that they had enjoyed a workshop that AMS Education had hosted. And we also included links to the official blog, which would be blogging about the different research events going on at the annual meeting, as well as our YouTube channel, where we were posting interviews with scientists and students to get their feedback. On the inside of the card, we actually, because it was like folded in half, we actually had a description of why you can use social media and how you could use social media as a member, and to have their voice heard as a member at this meeting. So it was a lot of fun. We got a lot of very positive feedback from the membership about it. And it was a great way, because everything had that identifier hashtag, AMS2013, we were able to sort all of the information at once and get a pulse on what events were really popular and what events maybe needed work on what was happening. And then we also were able to form new relationships between the organization staff as well as members on the committee and the membership. And sometimes I know in member societies, people don't fully understand what the role of the staff at a member society is. And so what it gave us the opportunity to do is show them, demonstrate what we do, but also tell them that we care about what they do also, and genuinely. It's a sincere concern about what their research is. Or I had students tweeting me on their flights over, and a couple of them were sort of joking that their school has a better student chapter, and we were able to just engage with them that way. And so it was really exciting to create new relationships. All right, Ellen, I will hand it back over to you.
thanks, Maureen. That was a lot of fun to be involved in that annual meeting project. And I'll just add one anecdote that shows how much response we got from the membership, that on the mornings of the first and second days of the official event during sessions, our hashtag was the number 3 trending topic. Which means that out of all the millions of Twitter users, we had enough participation using that hashtag that the other, you know, pop culture or news items of the day that people were talking about on Twitter, we were the number 3. Now on to slide 7, I'll just give you a snapshot of how the AMS policy program has a social media presence right now. Since our top 2 goals were to find others in our field and to have access to a steady stream of news and ideas about our interests, we chose to focus the most of our time and effort on Twitter. Since Facebook is still the number 1 platform that most social media users have an account on, we also made Facebook a priority. Thirdly, we shot a few short videos this year at the AMS annual meeting, so we created a YouTube account that can host those videos. And I'll get to LinkedIn in the next slide. So we have consistent branding across all our social media platforms. We use the AMS seal, and we use the same handle, AMS policy. On the left, you'll see our Facebook page. We drafted a brief phrase to summarize what we do at a glance and put that on our cover page, as well as an image, the Capitol building, that captures what makes our branch of AMS unique. You've got clouds on both the Facebook and Twitter as a supporting reminder of our organization's focus on meteorology. Since AMS's colors are blue and white, we use those colors whenever we can, as well as the same font that you'll find on our AMS website banner, the typeface. So there are 2 of us in the policy department that create the content on our accounts, myself and one other, and this is helpful because when one of us is unavailable to keep up the steady stream of new content, there's always someone who is able to do that, such as vacations and event, you know, someone's traveling. And we also have sort of a different eye for what makes an interesting piece of content to share. I tend to be more newsy, and my counterpart tends to be more human interest. So one item that I'd like to mention is that going back to extending your thought leadership, Bill Hook, who is one of the leaders in our department, has a blog that's professional use in his AMS capacity, and he talks about the intersection of science and policy and what kind of world we can envision and how do we accomplish, you know, those goals of creating a better world, and what are the consequences of us missing those goals. And he'll share his links to his new blog posts on his personal Facebook and Twitter accounts, and then I will retweet his posts as the AMS policy. And his blogs are then read by the reporters and other bloggers who follow his social media, who follow ours, who follow our content, and that's had some great consequences. For example, Andy Revkin, who does the New York Times Dot Earth blog, picked up Bill's comments after Superstorm Sandy, and the New York Governor Cuomo's office saw that article and asked Bill to be on a task force to improve the state policies for being resilient against extreme weather events. And another example is the Washington Post blog picked up Bill's comments on how the sequester might be affecting the National Weather Service. And then he was invited for a live interview on the Weather Channel on the first day of the sequester in March. And now there's gaining momentum. Word is spreading throughout the broadcast community now. And even today, he's been invited by the BBC to give a TV and radio interview about the Oklahoma tornado tragedy. And that's all started with his blog that we promoted through other channels, but also through our social media channels. Are there any questions at this point? Okay, moving on to slide 8. I'd like to share anecdote about another event that I was involved in, helping with social media activity, the AMS Washington Forum, which is an event we hold every spring to allow our members to have access to figures in Washington, federal agencies and congressional staff. This year we had about 120 attendees, and the organizers wanted to promote the event outside of the AMS community. So we did a press release, and we had we wanted to gain some momentum among those who were going to be attending our event. So even though we want to have this event as a place where attendees can contribute their thoughts candidly without attribution, as you can imagine, some topics around Washington can be pretty sensitive. So we have a non-attribution policy for the event report, for anything mentioned in the press that happens in the auditorium during that event. But that doesn't prevent us from promoting the event across the community and within AMS. So for one thing, we chose a hashtag that is simple to remember, related to the event, and easy enough that it's relevant to, that the hashtag is relevant to the topic. So we chose AMSWF for AMS Washington Forum. Another thing we did was to start a LinkedIn group, and we directly invited by email all of the attendees who had registered for our event. And for a few weeks before the event happened, we talked about some of the sessions that were happening to try to gain excitement for people to be attending. And one thing that we made sure to do was to get some the buy-in from some of the AMS leadership and staff who are heavy users of social media, so that they you know, are already in the habit of using social media to talk about what they're doing and just, you know, gain the momentum towards things that they're working on in the future. That would inspire others to listen, to consume that content, and then go ahead and talk about what they were looking forward to for the event. I was able to write a couple of blog posts for the official AMS blog talking about it. One thing that we decided to do was not create new accounts. So we didn't create an AMS Washington Forum Facebook page. We didn't create an AMS Washington Forum Twitter account. What we used were existing accounts, the main AMS Facebook and Twitter accounts, as well as the AMS Policy Program Twitter and Facebook accounts. And we posted the content about the event on those existing accounts. For one thing, we already had the followers. So it's, you know, already a baked in network that you can get your message out to. And the other advantage is that after your event is over, you don't have to worry about abandoned accounts, which can kind of look bad if there's no new content on a regular basis. And one thing that we did during the event was live tweeting. And I was pretty involved in that. So I would be sitting in the auditorium with my phone, listening for comments. And when there is kind of a nice soundbite or a good point that was made, I would just summarize that very briefly in 140 characters, use the hashtag, and then anyone who was not able to attend the conference was able to follow what was happening. I was very careful not to include names because of the non-attribution policy, but we were still able to reach a broader audience than those who were able to fly into Washington. Also, reporters and others could be listening in for their own coverage, and we were able to get some press coverage that way. Moving on to slide 9. I'd like to talk about a high-profile individual. This is Marshall Shepard. He's a professor and research meteorologist at the University of Georgia. He's also the director of the UGA Atmospheric Sciences Program, and this year he is the president of AMS. So examples of what makes him a high-profile individual is that he is frequently quoted in the media, and another example is that he has appeared before Congress as an expert in climate science from time to time. Marshall is a dynamic leader and a brilliant scientist and a gifted writer, and this those three coming together make him an excellent candidate for being a heavy hitter on social media. He lives and breathes social media. One advantage is that he speaks the language of his students. He's able to connect with them. And Marshall really knows how to follow the right people. He follows trusted, credible sources of news and information, people who are good writers, so it's share their content. And he also follows the up-and-comers, students or those who are just starting out in the atmospheric sciences field, to support them and engage with them and, help to use the social media channels to be a mentor. Marshall really seems to know about the breaking news instantly, and he'll share that on his Facebook and Twitter accounts. What he does to add value is he'll think about it briefly and then add his perspective, and he then disseminates it broadly for his followers. He seems to always have...
I have another question. If he's following somebody, the way I might see that is if he posts another comment, or would I see it because he's following it automatically?
Anyone that Marshall will follow, you can find out who someone is following by going to their profile and then clicking on their followers link. It'll show right below their name how many tweets they've done. You can see a list of their tweets. Then you can click on who their followers are and who he follows.
That's the way you would find out that you would get the information of people that he's following, is to actually follow them also.
That's right. When he wants to share the content of others, it's very convenient either on Facebook or Twitter for the pages that you like or the Twitter accounts that you follow. That appears in Marshall's news feed, and if he likes something that he sees, with a click of a button, he can share that with his followers. And then that will show when he retweets or shares something on Facebook, it will show the original content creator's avatar and name. And then underneath it'll say shared by or retweeted by Marshall Shepard. So he's giving credit to the original source, and it's a very convenient and efficient way for him to share the content of others.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, it's his own content. If I don't happen to know about an organization that he follows, and then I find that he has retweeted something and I follow Marshall, then I will see that.
Mm-hmm.
Way for me to find out who are the good people to follow, because Marshall's following them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
So Marshall seems to always have something thought-provoking to add. He answers the question, so what, to show why people should care about what's happening in the world or the significance of new scientific findings. And he's very gracious with praise of others in general and giving credit to others, and he does the same on social media. Even just kind words about the work of others, he makes sure to mention the handles or names of others that he's talking to, and he retweets the content of others. He encourages others to follow accounts that he likes. So an example on Twitter, if there are comments that that he makes that are intended just for one person, we can all read that, and it will... Just by following that conversation, it shows how passionate he is about science when he gets deep in the weeds, engaging in a conversation about a new development. And it also shows how much he cares about others. So he's very active on Twitter, maybe about 15 tweets per day on average. And on Facebook, he'll share photos and then one post every 1 to 2 days that are longer essay-type opinion pieces. And he's gained a following of people who know that these essay-type pieces are coming out, and they'll know to go back to his pages and his profile to follow whatever he's following or whatever he's whatever he's thinking about regularly. And now I'd like to share an anecdote that illustrates some areas to be aware of when you're using social media to communicate a message. Back in February, Marshall gave remarks before the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, along with three other climate scientists, to basically provide the status of what is happening to our planet with respect to climate change. It was a public briefing with live video on C-SPAN and streaming on the committee's website, so the world could watch, and prepared remarks were available in written form at the time of the briefing. Dr. Shepard is a gifted speaker, particularly in his ability to use analogies that illustrate climate change facts and concepts to non-expert audiences, including Congress. He talked about how climate change is like loading the dice and increasing the probability of the occurrence of extreme weather events. If an extreme event happens every time you roll double sixes, then climate change is replacing one number on one die with another six. He also showed how climate change is affecting agriculture right here in the U.S. Droughts that are exacerbated by climate change are affecting crop yields, which increase grain prices, which are in turn felt by U.S. consumers in the price of a box of Cheerios. And that was very quotable. So that was up on Twitter about how Cheerios is related to climate change. And the day after the briefing, Dr. Roger Pilkey Jr., a highly accomplished leader at the intersection of science and policy at Ceres at the University of Colorado Boulder, commented on Dr. Shepard's remarks. He said, "In a briefing to U.S. Senate, AMS President Dr. Shepard links increasing costs of disasters with climate change. Okay, I'll bite. Evidence?" Dr. Shepard replied, "Sources that I know you have concerns with, but also quantifying damage from Sandy, others, inundation, drought." They both continued tweeting back and forth to further their arguments, both willing to describe their perspective with neutral word choice and avoiding personal attacks. Dr. Pilkey pressed for sources, while Dr. Shepard provided brief responses. The discussion continued with 3,500 combined followers watching throughout the day for a total of about 75 tweets, including comments from others. I'll share some of the other tweets. "Thanks, but here's the problem. No, not what I was suggesting. Context lost in tweets. Think we will just have to agree to disagree, not trying to take shots. I hope we can work together in future. No agenda. Thanks for the exchange. Obviously, we will agree to disagree." An observer tweeted, "I've enjoyed the professional debate. If everyone can debate like this, we can make progress in the future." Now, what we can learn from this example is that social media can be a way for many listeners to conveniently listen to and benefit from conversations about climate science, but there are pitfalls to avoid. For one, tone is inferred by the reader. Another, it's difficult to capture precisely what you mean to say in 140 characters, and readers may not have the expertise and may not be able to fully appreciate both sides of an argument that deals with complicated sets of facts and thoughts. For instance, if readers only read the middle of this conversation and don't see the agreement to disagree and what that agreement refers to in this particular conversation, they might get the wrong idea about the gist of the debate. They might conclude that scientists generally don't agree about anything about climate change. So what you always need to consider is that social media is a public venue and consciously choose to make public everything you post. And consider that tone is difficult to convey and that comments can easily be taken out of context. The pressure with social media is the real-time nature, which can provide pressure to post even when you're not ready or wish you had more time to think about it. I'll stop here for any questions or comments.
Yes, this is Tamara. So you were just hinting at this, is that you said if somebody kind of gets to this in the middle of it, is it possible for them to look back at the previous and get the whole context, or is that difficult to do?
Well, it's probably easier the way that we naturally think if you're following it in real time, but it is possible to go back. This was on Twitter. So that the way that Twitter works is you can see a tweet, and if it is in a reply to a previous tweet, it will show view the conversation. If you click on view the conversation, then you can see what that tweet was in reply to and anything that was before that.
I see. And how far back can you go? Like, how, I don't know how long ago this conversation was, but if I choose to, could I go back and find that conversation?
Yeah, actually, I just had to do that to refresh my memory of how the event transpired. And it took a little clicking, you know, since both of the parties in this discussion are very active on Twitter. You can you know, scroll down. It'll maybe show you 20 or so tweets at a time, and Twitter automatically refreshes and includes the next set going in reverse chronological order, so that if you continue to scroll down and let those previous tweets load, then you can eventually go back as far as you want.
So, but then the other takeaway from this is, if you're not real adept at answering thoughtfully in a in-the-moment kind of thing, you might not want to do this.
Well, it's, you want to consider whether social media is the appropriate venue for a given conversation. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll move on to slide 10. These are just a couple of resources that I particularly like when I'm trying to learn something new about social media. The top one, Social Media Examiner. You can subscribe to an email newsletter that they have, or you can just go straight up to their site. And they keep on top of, for one thing, the newest developments when Facebook changes or if there's a new feature on LinkedIn. And you can also just, you know, go back, and they have kind of the evergreen topics that I find useful if it's something that I just didn't happen to know already. Another is Influential Marketing Blog, which is a little less of a general resource. It's more of a what's happening now. And then thirdly, I didn't get this one on here, but I recommend for those who are interested in Twitter but don't have as much of the nuts and bolts knowledge, it's the Simple Twitter Book. If you just Google Simple Twitter Book, it's by someone named Brent Ozar. And it's really just starting from the beginning, you know, what does RT mean, and what is a hashtag, and how do I create a profile, and, you know, what are some things to consider. And it really just, it makes it simple. It's only about 10 pages long in a PDF format, so I recommend that. And finally, the last slide, slide 11, our contact information. Feel free to keep up with us after today, and we'll also be back next week to talk about how CLEAN might continue on social media. And I'll stop there. Oh, I do want to call on Liz Sylvan. I don't know if she's on the phone. She's been managing the Facebook page for CLEAN.
Hi. I've been very much enjoying what you've been saying. I've learned a lot, and I think you did a great introduction in the beginning, too. I can tell you a little bit about what we've done on CLEAN and what we've been thinking about doing, and also how we've been doing it. It depends on what would be most useful for everyone.
Well, we just want to get, I think what we want to do is get a context of what we've been doing and what we've been thinking about, because that can, and I also want to invite anybody else to also contribute if you've been involved with an organization using social media to describe it a bit. But in the sense of CLEAN, it'll set the stage for our conversation next week. So could just give people an overview of what we're, you know, at this point, of what we've been doing up to this point.
Okay, sure. So CLEAN right now has a Facebook presence. We discussed having working with LinkedIn groups and also having a Twitter presence, but for just the beginning phases, thought that it would be best to start with Facebook. And so we now have sort of a regular set of things that we do. So usually at this point, Sarah Hill is doing this work. I don't know if Sarah's on the call or not. So we regularly every month we post the resource of the month, and we periodically just send out a post, you know, I don't know, two or three times a year, just saying what clean is in slightly different words. And then we, in addition to that, we also just post what we think are relevant articles. And the way we do that is that we use a tool called Hootsuite. I've been using it on other projects, and now Sarah's using it too. You don't have to use that, but we like that we can coordinate really nicely. And this becomes a little bit more relevant for Twitter, but is also relevant for Facebook. Multiple parties, so say Sarah posting, and then also I'm posting. And also if we want to follow different things in different ways, you can kind of have one list that you create of all the people who are the big organizations, and then you can have one list that's all the naysayers, or however you want to organize it. So we found that to be a pretty useful tool. Going forward, I think the things that we've talked about doing next are, one, being better about interacting with our audience. So we've been very broadcasty. We kind of just say this is what we think, or we're posting something for someone else. Oh, we also post about any events that are going on, of course. So if there's a call to get on or a workshop, et cetera, we post a couple times, you know, one ahead of time and one right when it's happening. Haven't had as much of that lately. But anyway, we are now at the point where I think the next step is to interact with other organizations and our followers better. We have had more followers over time and a greater number of likes on a given post now than when we first started out, but I think there's a lot of places to grow. If we had more people, we'd probably be more interested in getting in Twitter, too, because we saw Facebook as a way of just sort of connecting with teachers and average citizens and things like that, but the sort of more thought leader kind of stuff, Twitter might be a good mechanism to pursue, not, you know, to the exclusion of Facebook to get that audience, but, you know, it's complementary. And, yeah, we also talked about using LinkedIn groups, but really that discussion didn't get as far as we need to have a Facebook presence. We need to get it going regularly and post regularly. We try to make sure there's posts at least several times a week. Anyway, the way we do our posting now is we use this Hootsuite tool, and we'll sit down and schedule, say, a month of posts all at once. And then at least we know there's a baseline of stuff. And then as we see things popping up, we might post those too. But at least then we have, you know, we make sure that there's something always going out so that we're always making sure that we're posting. Now the downside of that approach is that we could probably do a better job watching and being responsive to people who like our stuff and such. But I think we've really come a very far, and I think the clean Facebook page is really doing what we set out to do as a first round, and we're just ready for the next steps. And I'm happy to answer questions about anything that didn't make sense with what I just said, but that's my couple-minute intro.
Well, thanks, Liz. One of the things that, and maybe Ellen and Maureen can comment on this, but we really did, in the clean effort, we didn't really have a lot of funds to support a person for really interacting with all of these social media tools. So this has been kind of done on a minimal budget, where my perception, and here, Ellen and Maureen, you can chime in here, is that you have a lot more time commitment to engaging with the social media than we probably do in clean. Is that the case?
This is Maureen. I actually don't. I'm specifically instructed not to spend a lot of time on it, which is why we're transitioning it to our intern, but I just like doing it. So for me, sometimes I'll just like do social media at home for the society because, you know, the news doesn't sleep, so if there's like a big tornado outbreak, you know, we can comment on it or, you know, get someone interested in science for it. It's really not, since I'm usually on social media for my personal use anyways, to like go over to another link and, you know, post a piece of information about it. And again, you know, that's what the intern is transitioning to be. And I know from my conversations with people at AGU and a couple other societies, it's definitely a task that is given to interns. Because as fun as it is, it's definitely may not be as cost effective for an employee, a salaried employee.
Okay. I can give, you know, my perspective from the policy program. This is Ellen. I do have the latitude to spend time on it, but it's there are efficient ways, like Liz was saying, you know, using tools like Hootsuite, you can schedule some posts. So if you've got, you know, some time all in a chunk, but you don't, you know, you want to save some content to share later, if it's not absolutely critical that that content goes out right away, then you can sort of store it up and then, you know, have it automatically scheduled to go out when you want it to, and that way it's just a, you know, more efficient use of time. It's also, you know, if you're planning on sharing the content of others, that's a lot faster than, you know, generating your own or, you know, waiting around for some new resource or, you know, original original content to come along. So there are ways of getting around the time constraints, although I agree it's something to consider before you start, you know, a regular program, because what you don't want to do is start a new social media program and be consistent for a while and then let it drop off.
Right. Okay, is there anybody else on the phone who has been involved with their organizations or knows, can describe their organization's use of social media and how it might play into what's been described so far?
This is Sarah May from the Monterey Bay Aquarium.
Mm-hmm.
We have an official aquarium team that does a lot of work with the aquarium's page. We have a Facebook page, a Twitter page, a Tumblr page, a LinkedIn page, you know, what's the other one? The picture page, Flickr. So we've got all these different accounts. And so we have an official team that does a lot of work. But I'm specifically the climate change specialist here at the aquarium. And so I use my personal account to connect with a lot of other people in the Clean Network, through the Climate Interpreter Network that I'm the content manager for, that was built out of a grant from NOAA. And I'm using a lot of Twitter and Facebook and Google Plus and those sorts of things to pass on content from other people. And I've recently started using Clout. And I don't know, I wasn't able to be on the first social media teleconference, but I was curious as to how people might be beginning to use that, because I've started using Clout to kind of keep track of how much reach I am personally having with other people.
Is that a tool for you, for social media, or is it a way of measuring your reach? I've never heard of Clout, so
yeah,
maybe you can describe it a bit?
Yeah, it's spelled Clout, and essentially you put into Clout all of your accounts. So Tumblr, Twitter, Foursquare, whatever you happen to be using, and it tracks how other people are using your social media. So if I put out a tweet and then my tweet is picked up by a bunch of people, then I get more Clout points. So I can track how my information that I'm putting out through my personal social media is being used by others in the social media context. And I've found that it's been really helpful for me to see what other people are following. And because sometimes I get confused with like retweets and following that sort of thing. It's been a really useful tool.
This is Ellen. I use Clout, too, just to sort of keep a general, you know, rough idea of how we're doing. I'm not entirely happy with Clout. I mean, I would say it's generally following it's roughly tracking how we're doing in terms of, you know, being more active, gaining followers over time and things like that. The reason I'm not as, I don't want to put a whole lot of stock into the clout score is because a lot of our content tends to be accompanied by a link. And I use a link shortening service. I use Bitly. And so I actually use I use that service. When I input a link, it'll tell, you know, it'll give me a really short version of it so that way I don't have to spend the whole allotment of characters in a tweet. Then I'll go back and I'll get the statistics on how many people clicked on that tweet. And clout doesn't cover the click rate for services like that.
Oh, okay.
I kind of wish they did. Maybe they'll add it in the future. I know they have been adding features over time. You know, they add different platforms that they cover and things like that.
Can you clarify that a bit when you say that? So if somebody clicks on it, if multiple people click on that small URL, it doesn't count the multiple clicks?
Well, sorry, I'm sort of, you know, I'm confusing some of the different platforms that they're using. Say I read an article on the New York Times, and I'd like to share that with our Twitter followers. I'll take the URL for where the article is posted and paste it into Bitly, which is the link shortening service, and then I take, and that'll give me a 20-character shortened link that's unique to me, not just to the URL. So then I'll take that and I'll copy it and paste it into a tweet. So anyone, and I say, you know, look, New York Times, you know, has this story today. So anyone who clicks on my tweet that contains my Bitly link will read the New York Times article, and they'll know it was because of me, because it's the unique, URL. So clout, which tracks things like retweets and you know, more likes, and, you know, just other statistics on the various social media platforms, it doesn't take into consideration how many people on my links.
It doesn't take into consideration what?
How many people are clicking on my links. And I personally consider that to be evidence that I'm engaging with my followers.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of, so I have similar feelings about clout, both that, you know, it's really hard to ignore, and I do check my clout score. I will admit that. but at the same time, as someone who has studied, you know, who's you know, really more of a researcher than anything else, their metrics are kind of ridiculous. They're not very clear about what their metrics are, and their metrics are influenced by their business model. So it's not a very good measure is what it boils down to. So it tries to know people who will buy its products that they have a higher influence score. They'll give you, if you are indicating that you're into a particular brand of coffee or, you know, talking about certain things, it'll give you what are called clout perks that you can spend. And that's really its business model. So it's not in the business of giving a good score. It's in the business of making money based on its score, which kind of makes it a little more. And, there's been criticisms ever since it first came out, and they honestly have never dealt with those criticisms. So there's, you know, for example, they kind of look at raw numbers. They don't sort of look at, well, within this community of people who are interested in climate change, this person's doing a lot, even though more broadly, you know, in the sort of global Twitter universe, they're not, for example. So it's all algorithmic based, and it was very crude algorithms as was being described earlier. So it is a reasonable thing to look at. Everyone kind of does, but I think it's just important to contextualize.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, statistically, it's not, you know, a very valid measure, but there aren't, I just find it's difficult to track sometimes, and I'm trying to measure my effectiveness, because if certain things aren't being effective, I don't want to be continuing to post them.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
And I don't know, and is there another tool that you know of that is a better tool at kind of keeping an eye on that?
Well, so I think what you can do if you, you know, I think the idea about using a link that allows you to see your clicks and where they are is probably reasonable. Facebook Insights is actually pretty good. It's not good, you know, Twitter doesn't have anything like that. But I do think Facebook Insights is helpful because they're, you know, and that makes sense because their business is more clearly aligned with you being happy with people looking at your page. I think that I am not aware of anyone trying to do some alternative to Clout. I'm definitely admitting that I also pay attention to it. But I think it also encourages kind of dumb behaviors. Like they like to see you replying a lot. So then, you know, you have people who will reply silly things just to kind of interact and get their Clout score up. It becomes this game unto itself that isn't really about, I guess, being a good social media citizen or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you very much. We are about almost 5 minutes past the hour, so this has been a great discussion. And Maureen and Ellen, thank you very much for your presentation today. And we will talk again next week when we'll talk about social media in the context of clean.
Thanks for the opportunity, Tamara.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.